from Senator Hoffman, Senator Green, Senator Donner, or Senator Ward, and Senator Wilkin. We have two bills before us today. And if we have any witnesses, I doubt that we have anyone to sign in, but please be reminded if there's anyone that wants to sign in, go ahead. We also have a teleconference site on Anchorage online, and I think that's listen only, is that correct? There will be testimony. The first bill is SB 9. It extends the Board of Architects and Engineers and Land Surveyors. And we have Heather Brakes from Senator Terrio's office to come up and present the bill. Heather, could you have a seat, please, and state your name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Heather Brakes, and I'm staff to Senator Jane Terrio, who is the sponsor of Senate Bill 9. Senate Bill 9 proposes the extension of the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors for an additional 4 years, out to June 30th of 2005. There was a committee substitute adopted in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee that also extends the temporary board member's seat, which is a landscape architect seat. The seat is a non-voting position on the board and was established by Section 31, Chapter 47 of Session Laws of Alaska 1998. That seat is also set to expire on June 30th, 2001, and Senate Bill 9 recommends or proposes the extenuation of that with the board. And in your packets, you should find several letters of support for this bill, also a legislative audit that was released in December, I believe, of 2000. With several recommendations, legislative audit found that the board was operating in an efficient and effective manner, that it should continue to regulate architects, engineers, and land surveyors, and landscape architects. It found the board is safeguarding the public interest by ensuring the competence and integrity of those who hold themselves out as such. It has also been found to serve a public purpose and has demonstrated an ability to conduct its business in a satisfactory manner. The board continues to propose changes to regulations to improve the effectiveness of the regulatory oversight provided by these professions. And most importantly, it states that the existence of the board provides more assurance that the various professionals it oversees are competent and promotes maintenance of the integrity of those professions involved. The three recommendations that were made in the audit, first of all, one was bringing this board into parity with other professional boards by requiring continuing education for the professionals. We had talked to several of the professionals that are overseen by this board, and as they all agree that those requirements are coming, at this point there's a lot of controversy as to what those requirements are or should be, and there was no support to attach that into just simply extending the board at this point. The second recommendation, it talks about replacing the mining engineer seat with the landscape architect seat, and again, this was another controversial point that the profession felt should not be attached to this bill. And in fact, the landscape architects are not proposing that happen either. This is a fairly new discipline, and they are just hoping to have the temporary board seat extended out for the additional 4 years. And at that point, if there is felt a need to make it a permanent seat, then they might support that. But at this point, no one is advocating it.
Heather, it's very difficult to hear in this room. If you could speak just a little louder, please.
Okay. Recommendation number three was talking about a statutory clarity for the licensing of architects, and the board has dealt with that through regulations.
Okay. Heather, could you just go over the fiscal note quickly? I understand that's all fees supported.
Yes.
Or if you wish, Ms. Reardon from the...
Yes.
Catherine, could you state your name, please?
For the record, my name is Catherine Reardon. I'm the director of the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Community and Economic Development. And my division provides the staff support for the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. And the reason I flagged you is because I thought that since it was my fiscal note, I could probably relieve Heather. The fiscal note is a zero fiscal note because the expenditure authority to regulate architects, engineers, land surveyors, and landscape architects and engage in the board activities are already in the existing state budget. However, for the purposes of full disclosure, I'm sorry, I apologize, I'm sticking to the last version. It's a $3,000 fiscal note in terms of new expenditure authority. But for full disclosure, we also attach an explanation of what we actually spent on regulation of the profession for the last two fiscal years, because I'd imagine that if you decided to stop having the board and stop regulating these professions, that that amount of money could be removed from the state budget. The reason for the $3,000 increase in our expenditure authority is the fact that under the current law, the non-voting landscape architect member cannot receive their travel to the board meetings from the division. The existing law says that all costs of their participating in the board meetings have to be borne by the board member. And that didn't seem to be like a very fair or good system. So in addition to extending the non-voting landscape architect member, this bill allows that person to get the normal per diem for food and travel to the board meetings. And that's where that $3,000 estimate came from. I would point out that the $3,000 will be generated through license fees, lease program receipts. So it will not be any increasing any budget gap problems.
Thank you, Catherine. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Catherine, I appreciate that. The second page, but I don't understand it. So
okay.
Could you help me with that? That says in 1999, we spent $522,000 on this effort and collected $131,000. And then in 00, we proposed to spend $551,000. But collect $1.095 million? I don't understand that table.
Through the chair, by law, each profession, professional licensing program, must cover its own costs through the fees generated from that profession or those professions. Since all of our licenses are issued for two-year periods, there's always a high revenue year and a low revenue year, and the high year is when everyone renews their licenses, and the low year is when just new licensees are coming in and maybe exams are being conducted. So the fact that there's a high and a low is totally appropriate. What we try for is that the revenue from the two-year license period and the expenses for the two-year license period equal. The other reason that they may not be exactly equaling here, although it's not too bad, is that deficits and surpluses from prior years roll forward. So sometimes we are intentionally under-collecting or over-collecting during a two-year period because we've got this, if you thought about it, like a checking account from the previous years that we're trying to bring into balance.
Thank you, Ms. Reardon. For the record, we've been joined by Senator Lehman and also the bill sponsor, Senator Terrio, in the audience. We have some people online to testify and someone in the audience as well. I'm going to go to the folks online first. In Fairbanks, we have Mr. Pat Kalin. Mr. Kalin, did you wish to testify?
Yeah, I guess I'm just a little the recommendation for continuing education. I believe that the board registration will be taking that up at our meeting in June on the 15th and the 16th of February. And we had at our previous meeting, we had taken a stand in favor of having authority given to the board. So I think that we're probably going to be discussing continuing education requirements a little bit more. We also, regarding that third item in the budget audit review, I heard Heather say that we take care of the architecture committee. Regulation, well, actually, we've had this problem with the regulation, certainly because of the conflict of statute. And we'll probably hear more from us by the time we're meeting. I think we might want to wait until after the Eastern show the legislation for the rest of the way. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Callan. It is Mr. Callan, correct?
Yes.
Okay. In Anchorage, Mr. Dwayne Adams. Mr. Adams, do you wish to testify?
Yes, sir.
Could you state your name for the record and what organization you're representing? Thank you, Mr. Adams. Amy Doherty in the audience? Okay, thank you. Was there any questions from the committee? Other questions? Maybe from the sponsor who's here? Senator Terrio, do you want to respond to questions? Senator Wilkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could we have the bill sponsor join us? he needs to understand that this is Senate finance and that we start on time. He's not on the other side anymore.
Yes, he does need to know that.
Yes, he does.
This committee waits for no one.
You almost passed it out without you.
Let's just have a moment of uncomfortable silence.
Could we have an idea, Mr. Chair?
And only Senator Terrio could answer this. How many people did this cover?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Excuse me. If we could have the staff come back to the
Senator, 1,132. How about that? Do you like that number? No. I don't know. We better have the staff.
Probably not for the record, that one.
I'd just like to divide the number into the cost just to get a sense of what it costs these folks.
Certainly, through the chair, there are approximately 5,000 people regulated by this board. I could tell you very specifically what professions you'd like.
No, just a total number. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Terrio.
Any other questions from the members of the committee? What is the will of the committee? Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, before we report this, I'll just note for the record that I am regulated by this board, and passage of this bill will cost me money. And specifically, including that landscape architect under the fees of the board will cost me another 60 or 70 cents a year. Anyway, having said that, I'll move that Senate Finance Report Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 9 from committee with individual recommendations.
A motion to move the bill. Oh, Senator Green?
Mr. Chairman, based on that, what I think I understood the man to say, they were going to be meeting here in February. Are their considerations going to be looked at and talked about and maybe this amended at some before this goes through?
I understand it's beyond the scope of the bill. Senator Terrio?
In particular, with regard to the continuing education, I'm not sure that I heard all the testimony and some of the concerns that were brought up. I know the regulated community is somewhat split on the requirement or the thought that there should be a requirement for continuing education. I had considered just putting permissive language in there, basically allowing the board through a regulatory process to bring that on. They'd be able to bring it on perhaps just for the engineers, just for the landscape architecture. They could do that by regulation. I did hear quite a bit of testimony that they weren't quite to the point, a number of people felt they weren't quite to the point that they wanted to take that on yet. And so I just chose to keep things clean. However, the legislature wants to add that with regard to the reciprocity or the comity, it's my understanding that that has been dealt with through regulations. That was the finding of the auditors. And so I did not put anything in statute, propose anything to be put in statutes on that. And I forget off the top of my head the third thing.
Heather.
Oh, and the mining engineer seat. We've been through that battle in the past and like to keep it the way it is. They've indicated that they have not had a real problem finding somebody to fill that mining engineer seat.
Mr. Chairman, I assume that people who are coming for this meeting could testify in another committee along the way, and so
that's
I remove
right.
my objection. Thank you.
And the title is worded broadly enough that those things can be considered anywhere along the process.
Senator Olson?
Senator Terrio, what are the consequences if somebody doesn't keep up with their continuing education?
Well, Senator, right now there is no requirement. If there were a requirement, their license could be suspended if they did not meet the continuing education requirements.
That's that's they can be fined as well, I'm assuming, or is that in statute?
This is Catherine Reardon. As the sponsor said, Mr. Chair, there is no requirement for continuing education now, so they've never had to face disciplining anyone for not getting theirs. I imagine that if they create a requirement for continuing education, that at the time of renewal, we would be asking people to certify they've done their continuing education. If they certified that they had and our random audit indicated that they had not told the truth, then they would be subject to the usual array of disciplinary action for lying on their application, which could be anything from suspension to a fine, to probation, to reprimand, the whole array of choices. If they told the truth and said, no, I didn't do my continuing education, then I would expect that we would delay renewal of their license until they came up with the hours. But they haven't had to face that situation because they're not at the point, apparently, as an industry that they're unanimous that they want to have continuing education requirements.
Senator Olson?
Senator Kerry, maybe you can answer this question as well. How available are continuing medical education seminars and those things that are out there? Because up here, obviously, it's very difficult to go and get out, especially if you've got something going on during the wintertime.
Through the chair, this is Catherine Reardon. I suspect that some of those concerns may be behind some members of the industry's reluctance to support a continuing education requirement. Since we don't have continuing education requirements, once again, there may not be as much systematic continuing education offered, and perhaps even Senator Lehman has some personal experience with what kinds of courses are offered. I haven't had to become familiar with that.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's the type of thing that if the legislature decided to go to that level, they could either spell that all out in statute or just empower the board through the regulatory process, which would be getting public input from the regulated community on what classes, how often, are they offered? Are you going to have to travel out of state to get them? Those would all be things that would come into play through either that legislative process or a regulatory process in implementing that requirement.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Olson, any other
questions? Only thing that I can say is that when you start taking away somebody's license, that's a pretty serious infraction that you can have on their livelihood. And I guess to go ahead and make more and more requirements means that you're going to have somebody to oversee that, which means a bigger and bigger government, more and more expenses, and unless there's an easy mechanism, I'm somewhat hesitant to go ahead and apply that requirement until there is something more established.
The objection has been removed. Are there any further objections? We still have a motion before us. Without further objection, the bill is passed from committee with individual recommendations.
Good job, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I only came up to peek in to see that you guys were being nice to my new staff person.
Well, we were real nice to her.
You should have stayed away.
You were very nice to her.
I hope I know the bill's going through state affairs.
SB 21, and it covers fines by the State Medical Board, and the sponsor is our own Senator Olson. Senator Olson, would you like to take a moment and present your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Donald Olson, the sponsor for Senate Bill 21. For the record, I introduce Senate Bill 21 to increase the monetary sanction that the State Medical Board may impose on a licensee upon the finding of professional or ethical misconduct. The bill increases the maximum penalty from the $10,000 limit that is currently in statute to $25,000. I feel the justification for Senate Bill 21 is twofold. First, I believe the maximum sanction of $10,000 does not provide a sufficient monetary deterrent given the economic status of many licensees. More often, the severity of the penalty is in no manner equivalent to the damage caused in extreme cases of misconduct. Furthermore, the $10,000 limit has not been changed since it was first enacted 14 years ago. A second reason for Senate Bill 21 is the increasing cost that the board is experiencing in its caseload management of misconduct allegations. It is not unusual for the cost of a misconduct determination to exceed the $10,000 penalty limit. Since the activities of the board are wholly supported by licensure fees and fines, increased cost of operation usually translate into increased fee charges. Senate Bill 21 offers a second way to meet the increasing caseload costs. It expands the board's cost recovery ability to increase fines. In practice, the financial burden for this regulatory activity may be shifted more from the general membership to the wrongdoers themselves. Currently, the board has 188 cases that are open for potential investigation and adjudication by the Division of Occupational Licensing. During the calendar year 2000, 130 new cases were opened and 133 closed. This effort resulted in 35 disciplinary actions against medical board licensees. In fiscal year 2000, the cost of pursuing misconduct charges exceeded $160,000.
Thanks, Senator Olson. Senator Olson, the costs are currently being shifted. There are enough cases to currently cause non-violating license holders' fees to go up.
Yes, I don't have the specific numbers, and maybe I could ask...
I guess the question is, it's not potential, it's actually happening.
It has happened that the fees for the licensure, that the renewal back in 1988, and then compared to the ones that were licensed again in the year 2000, have increased significantly.
Senator Green?
Like a really good idea, and I wonder why we aren't doing it in more of the different... Why we aren't broadening this concept out in those areas of high dispute and then these funds are these go directly into the on the account. They go directly into the medical board's credit account or whatever, and so it's a direct. This doesn't go into the general fund.
If I can ask the director of to come on up here, Catherine Reardon, to go ahead and give the specifics of how things are done, I'd be glad to go. But I totally agree with you that the burden of the wrongdoer should be shifted to the wrongdoer, no matter whatever it is.
Thank you,
Ms. Reardon. Would you like to testify?
Once again, for the record, Catherine Reardon, Division of Occupational Licensing, and my agency staff, the Medical Board. Yes, we consider fines received from a specific profession to be in the receipt, the new RSS receipt supported services category. And I think that probably technically they're part of the general fund, but they're in that receipt support and services category because, of course, you can't have dedicated funds. So, but we do credit them to the profession that they come from. And yes, the amount that we spend on investigation and discipline of wrongdoers greatly exceeds the amount of money that we bring in fines in any one year. If you think about it, the fact that we spend $160,000. Last year, just on legal bills and expert witnesses for the medical board, there's no way we took in anywhere close to $160,000 in fines from medical professionals. So it's a real situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rudin. Senator Green?
Yeah, could this bring it to sort of a net zero?
Through the chair, no. But I think that it could improve the situation and slightly improve licensee's feeling of fairness that those who do are found to have done wrong will pay more. I also think that, as the sponsor mentioned, the fact that the maximum fine hasn't gone up in a large number of years means that inflation and other things hasn't kept up with salaries and the cost of living, so it's no longer as big of a hit as it would have been.
I have another question.
Senator Olson, or Green, excuse me.
Thank you. Is there any, for the wrongdoer, who loses, is there any assessment of legal cost that they have to bear? As is in other civil cases? Are they?
You're asking if the physician or whoever, the licensee who has been allegedly done wrongdoing, whether he is found to be, if misconduct is found, does he go ahead and bear some of the cost by the state?
My
understanding that he bears no cost. If he's been either admitted to or been convicted of wrongdoing, that they bear no cost.
Is this appealable?
Through the chair, yes. The disciplinary actions by our licensing boards can be appealed directly to Superior Court and then on to the Supreme Court.
I think it's enough. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Green. Are you entertaining an amendment?
No, I won't burden this one, but I think it is certainly something to think of in the future. Because I know that in the past, as I recall, two or three years ago, the real estate licensees underwent kind of a cataclysmic event when they had a series of very, very high cost things, and they're suddenly paying three or four times what they had paid the year before, something like that. It seems punitive to the non-wrongdoers, and I think there might be something in this, though, that says that wrongdoers do bear a bigger share of the burden than just this big raft of licensees. You know, when we did the barbers and hairdressers thing last year and added the very novel tattoos and body piercing folks to it, at some point, that's going to cost every barber and hairdresser in the state a lot of money when there's a litigation over that wrongdoer by that license holder, and I don't think that's right. And I think we ought to be looking at all of these boards in light of making the wrongdoer bear a bigger share of that cost. Thank you.
Ms. Reardon, I have two questions. Thank you, Senator Green. The 188 cases that Senator Olson referred to, are those just the general ethical complaints that are out there, or are those complaints that are potentially finable up to the maximum?
Mr. Chair, all violations are potentially finable in that the statute says that for a violation of the statutes and regulations governing this profession, you can be fined up to now $10,000 and with this bill $25,000. So potentially the board could try to fine someone $25,000 for any offense.
Sure.
But because that's the maximum, certainly we consider that a worse offense kind of fine. And the way this process works is that the division, if our investigation finds evidence, sufficient evidence of violation of the law, then we file a charging document, an accusation, and the person has a right to an administrative hearing in front of a hearing officer. And the hearing officer, who's an attorney who's separate from my operation, certainly acts kind of as an administrative law judge and also views this as the maximum penalty for the worst offense, and, you know, medium offenses go in the middle and smaller ones go towards the bottom. So there's some protection there from our just charging everyone $25,000.
However, if you are the protections in regulation, or they kind of work out that way? I guess the reason I ask is if we aren't setting the fine high enough for the most egregious offenses, is there a danger that the people who commit more minor offenses will have higher fines to end up covering the cost of the administration of the program? And second of all, I guess that was all. Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the fines are intended to be disciplinary actions, not cost recovery actions. They do have the effect of helping to offset costs, but they're supposed to be like a reprimand or a suspension, something that is matched to the grievousness of your offense, not to how much you cost to catch. So there wouldn't be a process through which the division said, hey, we've got so much disciplinary money to cover, therefore we think this person with a minor offense should have to pay $25,000. Rather, we have to come in and argue this bad act merits this amount of money. It's intended to be a sanction, not a cost recovery.
Okay.
I would tell you, perhaps it just gives you some perspective, I looked at fines from the medical program for the last couple years. In 2001, calendar years, we've had four fines so far, most of these through settlement agreements, or all of these through settlement agreements. The worst case was a sexual misconduct case. There was a $10,000 fine suspended down to $5,000. In other words, if you do what you're supposed to, you only have to pay $5,000 of it. Then there are smaller ones for continuing education violations, which tend to be like $1,000. So that range is kind of worse. In 2000, there were 15 fines. Six of them were for $5,000, which was half of the maximum. They were bad prescription practices related, controlled substance prescriptions, things like that. Four fines in 1999, 14 fines in 1998. So $1,000 is kind of your continuing education lying on your application kind of baseline, and then $10,000 is pretty grievous thing.
Last question from me. Senator Olson or Ms. Reardon, Senator Green brings up a good point as to, you know, is this enough? And my question, I guess, is, this number of $25,000, you say it helps. Does is there a problem with boosting that? Do we somehow start losing support for the bill or something like that? Is that how we came to that number? Or?
I think that if you're Mr. Chairman, I think if you're a person that's a licensee that has been involved with some type of misconduct, I think you want to look at a punitive system that's somewhat incremental, somewhat and less than extreme, because we're starting to deal with some pretty large amounts of dollars there. And I think if you start boosting the limit all the way up to numbers that are quite a bit higher than we're talking about, you look at you're not looked at as somebody that has looked at it and studied it. And if you start going higher than that, it's my understanding that other states do not have a fine maximum that's nearly as high, much higher than we have.
Is this a number that the state medical board recommended?
Mr. Chair, the state medical board supports this. I suspect that the state medical board would also support a slightly higher figure. I know that there's at least one attorney at the table, and I'm not an attorney, but I think that when you get to, if you got up to maybe $100,000, some upper range, you may start bringing in legal issues about whether this the size of the fine makes it a
civil or criminal.
No longer eligible for civil situation. And I haven't been able to be told there's a dollar amount at which that happens, but you've got to watch that a little bit, apparently.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Two questions. So what is the number? What does the state spend to process these cases?
Mr. Chair, Senator, out of the division's budget, and we pay for all these costs, I would think that between our investigator salaries, the money we pay to the Department of Law, and the money we pay to expert witnesses, that we're probably talking about $2 million a year for all of our professions. I could go back and be more exact to you. I know we pay $600,000 a year to the Department of Law, $700,000 for expert witnesses.
Just for these violations?
No, I'm sorry, for all of our professions.
Oh, no. Well, just if we were to divide the number of cases, if we were to divide the number of licensees into the amount of money that it took, no, that's not right. If we were to move the $25,000 to some other number, what number would that be to recoup the average cost spent over the last 5 years in defending or processing these types of cases? What do the people invest in this?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the amount of money we spend investigating a particular case that results in disciplinary action varies extremely from a week of investigator time, negotiating a settlement with the person, settlement agreement to the person, which, you know, $1,000. I'm sorry.
How much have we collected, using the $10,000 limit, how much have we collected back from the perpetrator, from the violator?
I would estimate that we might get in a high year we might get $50,000, in a low year we might get $5,000.
So we're collecting $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And what is it costing us a year to collect that? To process.
Mr. Chair, if we talk about just the people who we investigate a lot of people who don't end up being disciplined. Maybe, if you want to do it that way. So if you don't want to count their costs, I would have to go back and look. I would say that $160,000, that wasn't counting investigator time or hearing officer time. That was just counting legal services, you know, paying for an attorney, and expert witnesses. So the number would actually be substantially higher. That particular number of $160,000 for last year, I would say that a lot of that money related to a case that has not yet resulted in its final action. So that $160,000, much of it, maybe $100,000 of it, was spent on a case when I can't look at you yet and say, and that person was disciplined, they were a wrongdoer. We're asserting they're a wrongdoer, they're still asserting their innocence. And we haven't been through the legal process yet.
So it would be proper then, in rough numbers, to suggest that it costs us $500,000 a year to do these things, and we've recouped under a $10,000 limit something around $25,000. So if we multiplied the $10,000 by 20, we would approach perhaps in rough numbers what it would take. So that would make the 200,000.
Mr. Chair, I feel like I need to go back and get my numbers and be more exact with you, but I would say that you'd have to have a very large maximum fine to have it pay for itself, larger than probably I would expect people to be comfortable with.
And you have the added problem of crossing from administrative to court actions.
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Wilson?
Could I ask that be done? I think it's important. We're only going to see this once. It's important that we understand that, I think.
I agree.
And I had one other question.
Senator Wilson?
Are these things, when the physicians are found guilty of wrongdoing and are fined, are those covered under EEO insurance policies? Do they go to their insurance, or do typically the insurance exclude this type of violation?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know. I think it varies a lot. First place, there's no requirement that our licensees have any malpractice or liability insurance. There's no state requirement. So I think a fair number don't. We can only guess from how much money they're spending on their defense whether they have some other source than themselves. Sometimes it definitely appears that they do have that kind of backup, and other times it doesn't. That's a very vague answer. Perhaps the sponsor, as a doctor, knows.
First of all, I'd like to make a comment earlier, Mr. Chairman, if I could, to the senator here from Fairbanks, that the main point of sponsoring this bill is because you're getting the flavor of what we're trying to do. And as long as I remain a senator, you can almost guarantee that there's going to be this type of incremental increase in some of the fines that are going out there. As far as your second question goes, as to who's going to be paying for what, I have never heard that a malpractice claim has been filed on behalf of a physician that has been either convicted of or has been admitted to misconduct, either professional or unethical. So it's my understanding, and in most cases, that the physicians are paying it out of their own bank accounts, whether from a corporation that they're working under or under other funds that they have available to them.
So
there's no third-party payer, from what I know.
If it was just a hand slap, if it was a continuing education $1,000 fine, that's obviously not malpractice. Would that be under EEO?
I don't think so. In fact, I'm almost sure it's not.
Thanks, Senator Wilson. Senator Donnelly?
Yeah, I have the same question because I was thinking that the professional mistakes versus the more intentional mistakes probably would be covered by some sort of omissions and errors insurance. So it'd be good to find out an answer to that because that's going to influence how I think about this next point I wanted to make. The next point I wanted to make is anytime we deal with this range of fines, or we set the higher level for a fine, the question arises is whether we're pulling up the lower level of fines that are generally set by the boards. And if that's not our intent here, I think there's a pretty simple way to address that, and that's by putting a paragraph of legislative intent in here that by raising the fine maximum, the intent of the legislature is to address the most grievous types of situations going on and not necessarily to raise the fines for people who are doing simple professional mistakes or whatever where there's not intent involved. And I think that would be well suited for something like this if that's the sponsor's intent. And I kind of think it is. I think we've got some, we're really trying to catch the bad actors here. And so I'd be interested in hearing a response to that. And second, I think when we do get the more serious offenses, I think it would be appropriate you could add some language here that said for those people who receive the maximum civil fine, the board could also assess them for the cost to the state of administering them for the prosecution that led to that fine. And there, so you got the really bad people who do something on purpose, they get the maximum fine, and they also have the option to assess them additional costs. They could have it. They wouldn't be required to do the full additional cost, but leave the option to the board to assess what they think is appropriate based on the culpability of the particular person who's being fined. So I think that would be something that might address the real serious problems that we're thinking about and yet preserve this concept that if somebody's only being fined $500 for some simple error and we just want to say, hey, don't do that again, we understand it was a mistake, you're not going to assess them $10,000 for the investigation of a $500 fine, but But for those people who really did something wrong and they intended to do something wrong and are getting a big fine, maybe we want them to bear some of the cost of that investigation.
Senator Donnelly, if we do something like what you've said, do we then take all the cases out of the realm of the administrative, of the board, and everyone begins to appeal to the court system because they have so much at stake?
Well, you're certainly not going to take all the cases. All the small cases that we've decided aren't going to be affected by those two changes at all. In fact, they're going to be protected by those changes. The only cases that somebody might be inclined to appeal were they're getting a maximum fine, and the board felt they were such bad actors that they wanted them to pay some of the costs to the state, too, of prosecuting them. And
they'd probably go through the courts anyway.
Yeah.
Senator Olson?
The only comment I have toward that, and that certainly is a good point that you have there, Senator Donnelly, is that my idea of making changes to do things in a stepwise manner, and this is the first step, and there'll be other steps in the future, but my intent is to go ahead and proceed cautiously.
Senator Olson, could you take this bill and maybe discuss with some of the members of the committee some of the changes that you've heard around the table here, and Ms. Reardon, if you could be available for questions from the different offices, to kind of maybe rewrite this bill somewhat, give us a CS that might incorporate the changes you've said, and then we can... Senator Green?
And I don't know if I'm going to say this correctly, but is there not a kind of a wall between what the medical board does? I mean, you may have be hearing a complaint against a licensee for your board, and at the same time, there is an ongoing court case going. And it's my understanding that these two have nothing to do with each other, and the information does not go back and forth.
Ms. Reardon?
Through the chair, Senator, they are unrelated, but information certainly may go back and forth. For example, when we mean the division, on behalf of the medical board, are investigating a complaint, if there is a malpractice judgment and a case out there that's come to complete, they certainly would try to go get that evidence that they've already considered and use it in our case. There's a requirement under state law that physicians that make payments in malpractice cases, either through settlements or being found in the wrong, have to report that to the medical board, because that's a trigger that we want to look into that situation. So there is information transfer, but the two processes and the two punishments are separate.
Do you agree?
If my constituent then goes to the Alaska Medical Board and said, I want to know what has happened in the life of Dr. So-and-so, a doctor I'm having trouble with, is there free and unfettered information provided to that person?
Through the chair, not free and unfettered. It is public information what malpractice cases have been reported to us. I say have been reported to us because some people don't do what they're supposed to and report them to us. it was payments were made. They don't have to report the ones in which they didn't end up having to pay any money. Accusations that we filed against the, and decisions that the medical board have, disciplinary decisions the medical board has reached, that's public information. Ongoing open investigations we consider to be confidential. Once an investigation is closed, either through disciplinary action or through deciding we don't have sufficient evidence to proceed or can't proceed, once they're closed, then the Public Records Act dominates the answer to that question. And when someone asks us for information about a license holder, we go through a process of looking through the investigative files, categorizing all the documents we have, saying to the Department of Law, okay, we think this is confidential, we think this is public, what do you think? We go through a whole review. And what the person may get is they may get 99% of the information with some names blacked out. They may get something much less of the information, and it depends on that legal analysis of the Public Records Act. And what we're analyzing there or trying to decide there is we're looking at the exceptions to the Public Records Act. Medical records are an exception to the Public Records Act. They're not public, so when we've gotten people's medical records through the investigation, we won't give them out. There's this balance between the constitutional right to privacy, apparently, and the Public Records Act that we sit there and work with the attorneys to try to balance out. And so it sometimes depends on who asks, because that balance between right to privacy and right to know gets tilted by who's asking, I guess. And it also is influenced by whether you're...
What do you mean by that?
Sorry,
what do you mean by that? Give me an example of a yes response and a no response.
Okay. Through the chair.
Mr. Chairman.
The easy example would be something like medical records that are clearly excluded under the Public Records Act from disclosure. So we would write back to someone requesting all the information about Dr. X and say, we've given you their public license file, we've given you information from closed investigative files, but here, and we mentioned what we haven't given you, but we haven't given you information we consider to be confidential, we haven't given you medical records that we've gathered in that case, we haven't given you witness statements in situations in which it's our assessment that witness's right to privacy outweighs your right to know. We also, if you're engaged in litigation with the state, then rather than asking us for the information under the Public Records Act, you're supposed to request information through the discovery process. So we say, Hulk, if you're engaged in litigation with us, you have to request it through discovery. We're not giving you any.
Ms.
I don't understand if you're involved in litigation with the state. Who would be suing the state?
Unfortunately, this is the chair,
the physician,
a number of people. Could be the physician or could be the unhappy consumer.
Mr. Chairman, my point is,
when
a person goes to the various information agencies about the records of physicians, if a physician has had several brushes with decisions and they're all decided and agreed to before it reaches the final stage in a court settlement, none of that information is public. And that is not obtainable by that person. No one will give them that information. This man has had, well, a woman has had seven accusations, none of which reached the final stage in court, but were settled out of court. Therefore, there's no public information. Then they go to your agency and they start saying, how many complaints et cetera, have been handled by your group, and under all these varying exceptions, then that person can essentially find out no information about the bad apple. And I think there's another thing that needs to be, and we're really getting off the senator's bill, but it does apply to the process of reviewing and assessing someone's performance with their patients. And I find it very, very difficult to explain to someone, oh, you're not entitled to this information because they settled it at the 11th hour. And then come to you, oh, we can't give you that information because we either have an ongoing investigation and or so-and-so gave this information, therefore we can't give it out. I find that how we get those two things together, where there is a supply of information for people to find out about the person who's going to work on their mouth, their eyes, or do their surgery. And if we don't have that free exchange, and we all end up protecting, I don't know who we're protecting, it's not the consumer. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need more response.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Olson, as we spoke before, if you could maybe work with some of the members of the committee to craft some language that might be a little more amenable to the committee members, with the realization that there may be some reasons that we can't change these fee structures, and Ms. Reardon, if you could supply us information regarding the some of the questions we asked about civil action versus or administrative action versus court actions and those kinds of things. Any other questions, committee? Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you, Ms. Reardon. We'll hold this bill over. Is there any other business to come before the committee? I would just remind you that, let me see if I have a schedule here. No, thank you. Just a brief reminder, on Monday we'll be having a joint meeting with the House to listen to the State of the University address from University President Mark Hamilton. There will be an overview by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education on Tuesday, as well as a discussion of SB 16, which is the Oil Discharge Prevention Bill. On Wednesday, we'll have a status of the Carlson case. And Senator Donnelly, we may be going into executive session on that. Is that correct?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So keep that in mind. We'll have signatures for those who wish to attend, and if you don't wish to attend, that's all right as well. And then on Thursday, we'll have an overview of the governor's supplemental budget by Emily McConnell. Any questions? With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.